It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. When I left the Zen Center, I left in order to do what I call the yes practice. Before that, all I did was complain. And even when I didn't complain, it was like accidentally something suited me. It wasn't like Suzuki Roshi said, when you do something with a warm-hearted feeling, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, is there and is there the true you is there. So the Bodhisattva of wisdom is there, Manjushri, Bodhisattva, and the true you is there when you do things with a warm-hearted feeling. And actually, that's practice. That's called practice. And that's how to take care of things and how to communicate with other people. So for me, I had to leave Zen Center to find this warm-hearted feeling. And I think that's why Tenchin Reb Anderson said, until you say yes, you can't practice Zen. There's a confusion, though, about yes practice, because it isn't ego-centered. It's not about, oh, okay, well, now I'm just going to do everything I want. It's not like that. It comes from a really deep place, and it comes from the same deep place that thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever, comes from. Thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever, implies a time when you would have had complaints. There's a complaint there. And then, but you're saying, thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever. And that, it's not because you're stifling your complaints, it's because you're actually you. You're actually the more grateful, non-discriminative, and compassionate person. That's the real you. Suzuki Roshi says, he says it very precisely, when we find the joy of our life in our composure, we don't know what it is, we don't understand anything, then our mind is very great and very wide. Our mind is open to everything. So it's big enough to know before we know something. We are grateful even before we have something. I'm thinking that yes, that full-on yes, is Buddha nature. The Buddha nature you think you have within yourself, because everyone has Buddha nature, that's not Buddha nature. But when you become yourself and forget all about yourself and say this, yes, that's Buddha nature. Dogen says that only when something appears is Buddha nature there. It's not something static inside ourselves. But to be completely concentrated on what you do wholeheartedly and unselfconsciously, that's Buddha nature. And the beauty of practice is that it can be extended forever. Dogen's kanji for today, I'm thinking, is about yes practice. It's about those two birds we've talked about who live in the high Himalayas where it's really cold. And every night the female says, "This cold is killing me." And every night the male bird replies, "We'll make a nest tomorrow." And this goes on for years. And in the bright sunny next morning, with lots of things to do, no one remembers what was said the night before. And this is about our spirituality, really. We try to improve our mind, and then the next day we forget, or it's too much trouble, or it just doesn't fit in. And this is how living beings stay in samsara. But in the context of Bodhidharma, the Buddha Dharma, Dharma is truth. Dharma is the truth of the real truth of all beings. In the context of the Buddha Dharma, this is about how can we live without complaining within dissatisfaction? Because we are in samsara, and samsara is basically dissatisfaction. So how can we live without complaining within dissatisfaction? It's tricky. How can we be released from the suffering of the continuous cycles of sickness, old age, and death? How can we say yes to what we need to do to make that happen? So here's Dogen's poem. How can the three realms and 10 directions be all one color? Who would discuss the difference between human and heavenly beings? Do not convey talk of birds suffering in the cold. The lake with no heat of anxiety is on the snowy mountain. So in line one, how can the three realms and the 10 directions be all one color? I'll just unpack this a little bit because you'll be hearing these phrases used. If you continue studying Buddhism, they're common. The three realms is a translation of Triloka in Sanskrit. They refer to the realm of desire, the realm of the material, and the realm of without material. And in the first realm, desire, our realm, people are always transmigrating within six, they're called realms. So you've got a big realm, and then you've got six big like divisions. Hell, and so there's three lower and three upper divisions. And the lower ones, hell and hungry ghosts and animals. And then the upper ones are humans and asuras, they're fighting gods, and then heavenly beings. And those six realms depend on karma that's laid down in previous lifetimes. So beyond the six realms within the desire realm, there's two more realms, the realm of meditation with and without material things. Sometimes it's said form and formless. And together, so together, the desire realm, the, let's say, form realm and formless realm, those are, that's what is samsara is. And they're the three realms within living beings are transmigrating. But also the three realms is used as a common Buddhist term for everywhere in the whole world. The 10 directions is actually that you already know what the 10 directions are: north, south, east, and west, and the crossway and up and down. So, but it's also used to refer to all the Buddha lands in the entire 10 directions. So here Dogen uses the three realms for the entire world in which all living beings are transmigrating, and the 10 directions for the entire world as Buddha land. But the important point for you is all of this is about the nature of your mind. It's just the nature of your mind. There's not this realm and that realm. It's all inside you. It's all about our consciousness. For example, we in the desire realm can cycle through all six divisions in one day, in 1 hour, really. We can just go through all these experiences of being in the hell realm, being a hungry ghost, which is like ravenous, but you can't eat, etc. So line two, who would discuss the difference between human and heavenly beings? It implies that humans and heavenly beings are different. In the heavenly realm, all desires are filled. And in the human realm, there's constant dissatisfaction. But it's our mind that creates both realms. And this is good news because we can tame our minds. We can tame our minds to be kind and considerate of others. We don't have to be in the hell realm. And regarding the third line, do not convey talk of birds suffering in the cold. It's a way Dogen has of speaking of human beings. It's just the way we live in samsara. And to talk about that, Dogen uses these two birds who make good plans when they need to, but then they forget about them when they actually could implement them. Okamura Roshi gives a great example of this not complaining thing. He says that in Antaiji, in Kyoto, they had only one kerosene stove. And one winter, they couldn't buy kerosene. So they had to sit in the zendo without heat for the entire winter. And it was really cold. He said, in Kyoto, instead of snow, they have ice. So it was below 32. And then on the other hand, Kokoji, which is Katagiri's monastery in Minnesota, where Okamura Roshi also practiced, he said it was the hottest place. And one June 5th, a day of Sesshin, it was over 100. This kind of situation, and everyone is complaining. And he said, this is the way we create samsara. We start to sit in the zendo and people complain. But priests, he points out, they have to wear four layers of clothes no matter what the temperature. And lay people can just wear t-shirts in this 100-degree weather. But ultimately, Dogen says we should try to keep the place where we sit warm in the winter and cool in the summer, but sometimes we can't control it. So we make a resolution to sit with whatever conditions. The last line, the lake with no heat of anxiety is on the snowy mountain. This lake with no heat of anxiety comes from the fourth chapter of the Lotus Sutra, where this word anxiety can be translated as there's no passionate ways, there's no torment, there's no burning anxiety, and there's no annoyances. Those are four ways to translate that word anxiety. I'm just going to give you a taste of Buddhist cosmology, just a teeny bit. So there's a book called The Abhidharma Kosha, which is a composition by a man named Vasubandhu, who lived in Kashmir in the 5th century. And it's considered the highest authority on any dogmatic question, the Abhidharma Kosha is where to go for the answer. And in that Abhidharma Kosha, it said that in the world there are five continents, and we live in the second continent. And in there, there's a huge lake on the northern side of the Himalayas named Anuvatapata, which means no burning anxiety or no heat or without problems. So it's a source of the four great rivers in India, the Ganges, the Indus, the Oxus, and Sita. And it's said that in the lake, a dragon king whose name is Anuvatapata is living. And Dogen points to this lake as a condition without suffering. So there's two sides. There's samsara, suffering, and there's nirvana, without suffering. But these two live in the same place. The lake without suffering is in the Himalayas, and the two birds are also in the Himalayas. So the two sides are different, but they're in the same place. That's the point. And he's talking to his assembly. This poem is given to his assembly, like in the morning Dharma discourse. And he says, now we are living like these two birds. So now we are complaining, but we're also in the lake without problems, which is to say, don't complain. Keep bodhicitta strong and determined and continue to practice. And the point of this poem is the same as there's a koan by Dongchan. The founder, we've talked about him before. He's the founder of the Chinese Soto Zen. And the koan is, so a monk says, when cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? And Tozan, the Zen master, says, why don't you go to the place where there's no heat or cold? So the monk says, is there a place where there is no heat or cold? And Tozan says, when it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. So in other words, kill yourself with cold and kill yourself with heat. And I think kill yourself means your ego self. That's seventh level of consciousness. But it means wholehearted practice. It means you sit until there's no self to feel the cold, actually. It's like the monks that I've referred to before who do a marathon every night, starting at midnight, and they carry a knife with them because they vow that if they don't complete the marathon, they'll kill themselves. And I remember using this in my book for writers, One Continuous Mistake. Because this no matter what attitude is really important for practice of any kind, and in this case writing practice, but practice of any kind almost requires a no matter what attitude because of the way the world is. Once you set an intention, the entire world, now this is Gail talking, once you set an intention, the entire world sweeps in with obstacles for your intention. It just literally sweeps in. And so you have to have this no matter what attitude, or you won't do your intention. It's just, I'm convinced of that. So I guess you could say that the way these birds live is the life in samsara. And so when we have sad or painful experiences, we we resolve to practice, and then as soon as they're taken care of, we forget all about our resolution. And we have this difficult time over and over and over. We repeat it again and again. And Dogen's message is, we shouldn't convey the bird's message. And instead, once we arouse bodhicitta, we should make determination to study and practice single-mindedly. Probably Dogen made this poem to encourage his monks and to encourage himself to practice in these very cold and really bitterly cold conditions in the North Country in Japan, where Eheiji was. But once we begin to complain about the conditions we're practicing in, our life becomes samsara and we want to escape, but we need to settle down right there and find something meaningful. And that same place can be a Buddha land. I have one more poem by Dogen for you to enjoy. It's a version of a poem we've already heard. It's almost the same, but it's just a little bit different. I feel Dogen just as a person speaking in these kanji, and so for me that's why they're interesting. So this one is called One of Six Verses on Snow. And he says, all my life perplexed by truth and falsity, right and wrong. Those are dualities. Now amusing myself in the moonlight, laughing at the wind, listening to the songs of birds. So many years spent idly contemplating the immense white layer on the mountains. This winter, all of a sudden, I realize that the snow piled high is itself nothing other than the mountain. And that means he just realized there is no duality here. There's not snow on top of the mountain, that the snow is the mountain. It's all one thing. There is no snow without the mountain, and there's no mountain without the snow. And yet, the snow is the snow, and the mountain is the mountain. That's how it goes. So, in other words, there's individuality and there's oneness, and they both simultaneously exist. Here are a few kanji by me. I hope that you'll enjoy. The first one doesn't have a title. It goes, the sun with a smell of coolness sinks. A slow drizzle falls. A man dies, but it's not a breach really. Jasmine and rose follow him everywhere. And then this second poem is called A Thousand Wings, Their Shadow. The temperate blend of creek, hot spring waters, heat, and internal pressure altered but unrelieved by winter cold. Intense quiet, its affluence full. It did snow while I was at father's, but it only depressed me. And here's another one. It's called Sweet Moses, the bulrush. Before dawn, long before dawn, early, early morning, by virtue of this joy, one is set apart from others. Yesterday, in an accident, your dear sister died. Late snow, mudslides, I get goosebumps. So here are the most important points from today. In this series on Dogen's Kanchi, I've been trying to have just one main point each time. And today's main point is I have no complaints whatsoever. So the first is, but these are other points from today. When you do something with a warm-hearted feeling, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, is there, and there is the true you. When you do things with your warm-hearted mind, that is actual practice. And the second point, thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever, implies a time when you would have had complaints. Now you don't, not because you're stifling them, but because you are your actual you, a more grateful, non-discriminative, and compassionate person. And the third one, even before we attain enlightenment, we are happy to practice our way. Otherwise, we cannot attain anything in its true sense. I'm not sure I said that exactly, but that's in there. That even before we attain enlightenment, we're happy to practice our way. And that being happy to practice our way, which is warm-hearted, wholeheartedly doing whatever we're doing, that's our way. And Suzuki Roshi says, otherwise we cannot attain anything in its true sense. And I know I definitely feel that whenever I stop being wholehearted and think, oh, well, I'll just kind of sloppily do this. I don't use that word, but there's not the same feeling afterwards. There's a real clear difference. And the fourth main point, Dogen says that only when something appears is its Buddha nature there. It's not something innate within ourselves. To be completely concentrated on what we do, that's Buddha nature. And fifth, Buddha land is not an other world. All this is about this world, where we are. Within this one color, there are three worlds plus Buddha lands. All these are created by our attitude toward our life. And sixth, we have to work within our difficulties, how to keep our determination, how we can live without complaining within dissatisfaction. It's a real conundrum. How to live without complaining within dissatisfaction. And then finally, when we find the joy of our life in our composure, we don't know what it is, we don't understand anything, then our mind is very great, very wide. Our mind is so open, it is big enough to know before we know something. we are grateful even before we have something. And here are some ideas for reflection during the week. First, what does the phrase warm-hearted feeling look like in you? Please give an example of something that you're doing with a warm-hearted feeling. And if you can, to describe the actual physical, what does it feel like inside you? What does that warm-hearted feeling create inside you? How does that feel? For me, it's not necessarily warm, actually. It's just very spacious. It's both concentrated and spacious, I would say, for myself. Secondly, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever is a practice of non-discrimination. And I wonder if you can give an example of a time when you've practiced this non-discrimination, or when you didn't practice it and on reflection wish you had. And thirdly, this idea of Suzuki Roshi's, when we find the joy of our life and our composure, we don't know what it is, we don't understand anything, then our mind is very great and very wide. It's open to everything, so it's big enough to know before we know something. We are grateful even before we have something. I'd like you to give an example of experiencing this state of mind from your own life. Just really feel into it and give an example of when you had that openness. And better still, maybe there's something that you do regularly where you have that openness and you can be more conscious about it. And maybe even transfer that to some other things you do also. This idea, this is the fourth one, that we have to work within our difficulties to keep our determination. It's really hard. It's like those birds. It's hard and they can't do it, basically. The point of this reflection question is that if you know that it's hard beforehand, then the next time you have a difficulty, you can stop and say, oh, here's an opportunity to adjust my attitude. Like, wait, I should be grateful for this difficulty so I can practice consciously keeping my right attitude during it, which is I have no complaints whatsoever. But not just doing that, but the state of mind where that comes from, which is a very large, spacious mind and non-discriminative. See if you can, the next difficulty you have, just see if you can wait and stop and be more conscious about how you navigate that one. And the last, fifth one, is to write, if you can, write about yes practice. And so it means that your life is set up so you only do those things that you say yes to wholeheartedly. Otherwise, you don't do it. So you really have to be discriminating. In this case, you're deliberately discriminating the things you say wholeheartedly yes to and the things that you don't, and you start eliminating those things from your life. And I was going to ask you to make three lists, a list of your yes things, a list of your I'm not sure things and a list of your no things, and to try to, if you could, take one of your I'm not sure things and see if you could push it to wholehearted yes. And if you could eliminate, slowly find a way to eliminate the things you say no to, just get them out of your life altogether. So then your life is only things you say yes to, which is how it should be. You only do things you say yes to. I wonder if you have questions.
Yes, Gail. The first one that we have is, can you say more about what Dogen said about Buddha nature? Only when something appears is its Buddha nature there. It's not something innate within ourselves. I thought everyone has Buddha nature.
So if you say everyone has Buddha nature, then this is duality. And that isn't the way the world is. If Buddha nature is only there when something appears. So Buddha nature appears through action. And it happens even when you're not thinking about it. So for example, those birds in the morning when it's bright and sunny and they fly off to do whatever they do, that's their Buddha nature, really. They're doing their bird things. But we're not birds. And I think probably in there, there's just as naturally a Zazen practice is probably in there in our natural lives. But the point here is that Buddha nature isn't dead. It's not something that like we have. It's not a possession. So we have to kind of make way for it. And we have to act, and to make way for it, we act with our wholehearted, grateful, compassionate selves all the time, all the time. I hope this helps. Thank you.
So the next question that we got is, the idea of yes practice appeals to me, but I think I would just follow my instincts from minute to minute, and that would end up being looking at my phone, watching news or Netflix, or doing crossword puzzles all day. How do I make it into something larger? I wish I could, but I don't see how.
I know, I see. I had a lot of motivation because I felt I had completely failed for 11 years of my life trying to practice Zen in a community. It totally didn't work. And I felt humiliated and devastated, and I didn't know what to do. So I had a lot of motivation. I mean, I really had to change things. So the first thing I did was, I'm going to bed and I'm not getting up till I know what I want to do, really, what I really want to do. And for the rest of my, what is my life's work? And there was this teeny little voice that said writing. And so I had a hint. Wasn't a big thing though. But I, what I want to say to you is that we have to have our right direction. We have to have the right direction of where we want our life to go. What is the correct direction for our whole life before we can make, what should I do next? Honestly, if you don't know what you're trying to do with your life, then all the small decisions along the way have no reference point. So it's really, really important in terms of you doing yes practice that you know what you're saying yes to in the biggest way first. That's really critical. And I think some people kind of just go along in their lives from one thing to another without having that kind of vision. And that vision is truly important. So without that, I don't know if you can do yes practice, frankly. Or it's, the other way it could go is that you do yes practice and from doing it, learn what the vision is. I think it could go that way too. Okay, thank you, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. Next question is, this question is about three realms. Sorry, there's one question before that also. I'll ask this one before the next one. Can you say more about Buddha nature? I never feel that I completely understand.
The reason you don't understand is that Buddha nature is an ultimate truth. Ultimate truths cannot be understood with our ordinary minds, nor can they be put into language. So they can't be expressed in words. So their essential nature appears through wholehearted action given generously and unselfconsciously. So in Zazen, we take this posture, for example, and the whole Buddha Dharmakaya, the Dharma body of the Buddha, the true reality of all beings, gets expressed. When we take this posture, that's what happens. Because Zazen does Zazen. So we don't have anything to do with it except taking the posture. That's Buddha nature. So what's Buddha nature? You know, I'm not sure. I don't know. I can't say exactly. That's the right answer. That's the right answer. Like, I don't know. I can't say exactly. That's the correct answer to what is Buddha nature, because it's an ultimate truth. No one can say what Buddha nature is, but it's definitely not your own, you know, little teddy bear in your stomach. Like a lot of people feel like, oh, well, I have Buddha nature. It's not that. But we also cannot express in words or even with our minds, think what an ultimate truth is. And Buddha nature is an ultimate truth, and that's why there's so much confusion about it. I think we want to kind of have it, and that's the very thing we don't have. have isn't a word that goes with Buddha nature. I hope that helps. That, I mean, it should help. That if you know that no one can say what Buddha nature is, then you should feel like you're not, you know, a klutz or some whatever. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So this next question is about the three realms. So someone asked, I heard you say two contradictory things. You said that we in the desire realm end up in one of the six divisions depending on the karma we've led down in previous lifetimes. And also that these realms are about our attitude and state of mind. I think I'm confused.
So it's actually like both are true. But here's how it works. So let's say, you know, it's funny. I've noticed that some people are so one way all the time, like let's say angry all the time, that it looks like that's who they are. They're just an angry person. But, and some people are angry sometimes and some people are hardly ever angry. But so for the people who are always angry, it looks like they've laid down conditions, causes and conditions to be this way. But you know, the real truth is that we're in charge. We're not, we have minds and we can tame our minds. And each of the six realms that we can shuffle through all day long, they do exist. All you have to do is look. But we can learn how to behave. And if we learn correctly how to behave, and hint, warm-hearted, compassionate, and grateful feelings, we can be in Buddha land, even though everything else is also true. So all you have to really know is you're in charge. You get to choose where you live, and you can live in the hell realm or you can live in Buddha land, and it's really up to you. That's the whole point. That was Dogen's point to his monks, and that's the point of this talk today. Also, it's a point of thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. That's you living in your own composure, no matter what happens. You living in your own composure. And Suzuki Roshi says that's it. That's Zen practice. That's where it's at. You living in your own composure. So you hold that, even though it changes minute to minute, you stay living in your own composure. Those are the three realms. You living in your own composure. I hope that helps. I'm not saying it's easy, but that should help. That's the main point. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question is, I'm pretty satisfied with my life, even though it is filled with a mix of things that I say yes to and things that I do out of obligation. The obligations are things I do for survival or for social considerations. I feel like if I only did what I said yes to, then I would later have regrets for the things that I neglected. Is this fear justified, or is it just rationalization for not doing yes to everything?
Well, actually, I heard within your question that there is a yes to these other things that you're saying no to, or you're at least not saying a wholehearted yes, that you want to do them for the sake of your life, the upholding of your life, and also for social justice reasons, or social reasons, to help other people. And so what my answer to you right now is, without knowing you better, is to try to find the yes that's already there in those things that you think you're saying no to. It seems like there is a yes there. I hear it. I didn't hear I'm doing something that kind of violates who I am in order to make a living. If you're doing something that violates who you are in order to make a living, you actually need to find another way to make a living, and that doesn't violate you. And the best is to find a way to make a living that you already know you say a wholehearted yes to. But you're doing these at the really, just to stay focused on your question. To listen to yourself. If I heard a yes there, I think you can get to hearing a yes there also. That's my answer. Thank you,
Gil. So the next question is, can you say more about the qualities of the six realms we're cycling through?
Yes. So from bottom up, so there's six of them, and they're called the three lower realms and the three upper realms. And the three lower realms start with the hell realm. And Buddhism, like other, I don't really think of Buddhism as a religion, but let's just say like other religions, really jazz this up a lot, the hell realm, and, you know, this fire and, you know, the whole thing. So people can stay in the hell realms for lifetimes. And some people have done things that they actually need to stay in the hell realms for lifetimes. That's the lowest realm. But by the way, there are some bodhisattvas who are devoted to going into the hell realms and saving beings from the hell realms, because this is all samsara, and bodhisattvas stay in samsara in order to help save other beings. So some bodhisattvas are devoted to saving people in the hell realms. And then the next one up is the hungry ghosts, who they're hungry all the time, but their throats are really narrow. And so they can't eat. So they're ravenous. They're ravenous. And I think it's not that hard to relate to that ravenous temperament. And that's the hungry ghost temperament. And up from there is the animal realm. And some people feel like, well, why are, you know, my beloved dog, why is it in the lower realms? Animals are at the top of the lower realms. And it's because they're not free beings. Their lives need to revolve around, well, like those birds. Their lives revolved around getting food all day long, getting food, reproducing, and having a warm place at night. That's it. So there's no room in there for attaining enlightenment, for example. And which brings us to the next realm, the lowest realm of the higher realms, which is human beings. And human beings are, that's the most coveted incarnation, because only the human incarnation can attain enlightenment. And so it's said that, therefore, that's what we should be doing in our lifetime. That should be our main focus, because we're in a unique place and we should do what our uniqueness qualifies us for. And so that's special to human beings. And in Buddhism, it's said that it's very rare to attain a human incarnation. It's extremely rare. That's, I know that's not how we look at it, but that's how Buddhism looks at it, unequivocally. So then the next one up is the angry asuras, the angry gods. So we've already talked about, they're angry all the time, and anger rules their lives. And that finally, the heavenly gods have everything perfect, but they also know they're going to lose it. It's only temporary. And so there's also a lot of fear there. And then when they do start losing it, they're shunned by the other gods who don't want to touch it. So it's not the best place to be, actually. The human realm is the best place to be. I think I'm almost out of time. And I want to say two things. I want to absolutely thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, for their amazing work behind the scenes to make these talks possible, for which I'm so grateful. And yourselves for attending, for which I'm so grateful. And for which I need to remind you that next Sunday, we're taking off for the Thanksgiving holiday. And so there'll be two more talks in this series, and they'll start the week after next Sunday. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.